Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. In China, they call it the silver hair industry. But the turn of the century, one of three Chinese people will be of retirement age, and it's fast becoming a gold rush for many Australian companies. The rapidly aging population has big implications for the Chinese economy. It prompted the recent scrapping of the one-child policy. But it also created an unprecedented demand for nursing homes in the country that's traditionally regarded them as shameful. China correspondent Bill Birtles reports.
82-year-old Leander Hai says he's living the good life. Along with his wife, he lives in one of the first Australian-run nursing homes in China on Beijing's northern outskirts.
This place has solved two issues for us. My wife has a problem with her legs. She can't walk downstairs. And beforehand, we lived on the fourth floor. It was very hard. Also, if we had an emergency, it would be difficult. My children were not around to help. I had to rely on the ambulance, and to tell you the truth, I couldn't handle it.
His son lives in Beijing, but runs a business and has his own kids. The traditional Chinese preference for the elderly to live with their children wasn't an option.
In China, we have an old tradition. Having sons and daughters around you is your destiny when you get old. I think this tradition is now shattered. If we stay living at home, there are still lots of problems. Your children can't be around all the time. They have their own career and their own children.
It costs Mr. Lian and his wife more than $44,000 a year to live in a top nursing home. That's well out of reach for the average elderly couple. The waiting lists for public nursing homes are extremely long, and experts say the nursing standards in them are low. Zhou Ming-Ming heads a Beijing elderly care centre called Yinian. She says the demand for nursing homes is only going to grow.
China's traditional culture taught people to raise a son to support the parents in old age. To send the parents to a nursing home is seen as unfilial. This is a traditional concept. In recent years, it's been gradually changing, but it won't change overnight.
A delegation of aged care providers recently travelled to Beijing, backed by the Minister for Aged Care, Susan Lee. One company, Independent Management Group, is in the preliminary stages of a joint development that would accommodate 9,000 elderly people in China's northeast. The managing director, Susan Malone.
It is a massive industry, and the scale to us in Australia, where we normally work with villages that might be 100, 200, 300 or so units, where 500 units is a very big village, we're talking thousands of units over here.
China's government wants to see the nursing home industry grow. It's facing an extraordinary economic burden. One in three people will be of retirement age by 2050. That's why Australian companies are taking a bet that nursing homes will become more appealing. Julie Jackson is the managing director of Aveo. Her company is building a 2,500-unit aged care facility in Shanghai.
Well, there's going to be 400 million people over 65 by 2050. From a country of only 23 million for our whole population, that's a huge market. Even if we only captured 5%, that's still 20 million potential customers for this industry.
17 people who arrived in Indonesia's West Timor province after their boat was stopped by Australian authorities off Christmas Island say Australian authorities sank the original boat, then loaded them onto another fishing boat for the trip back to Indonesia. Indonesian officials, who say they were given no notice of the action, want an explanation from Australia. Tim Palmer speaks to Indonesian correspondent Adam Harvey, and he asked him who was aboard.
Well, I've spoken to them here in Kupang, and they've told me that they're from India, Nepal and Bangladesh. There's 16 of them. Most of them are fleeing economic problems, crises at home. No one said that they were fleeing persecution.
So can you trace their voyage for us, as much as you know, from start to finish, that finish in West Timor?
Well, once they got to Indonesia from India and Nepal, they met a people smuggler, and they got on a boat in Java somewhere. They said that they weren't exactly sure where it was because it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and they had a three-day journey to Christmas Island. They said that they were told to stay in the hold of the boat and complained about the fumes the heat, and they said it was a very difficult journey. They were relieved when they thought that they had finally made it to Christmas Island, and they didn't. They got to the mouth of Flying Fish Cove, and that's when the Australian Navy intercepted them. They were then taken on a six-night journey by the Australian Customs or Navy officers who took them away from Christmas Island. They steered the boat out to sea. They say at about 40 to 50 miles out to sea, they scuttled the asylum seekers' boat. It sank. They were brought on board the customs ships, and then over the next few days moved closer and closer to Kupang in West Timor. They were steered finally, put back on another fishing boat that the Australians had, and steered towards Kupang. And they ran out of fuel a few miles out of Kupang. They said that a local fisherman helped them get back to shore where the Indonesian authorities picked them up last night at about 5:30.
So this isn't quite a boat turnback, nor is it using one of those orange lifeboats. This seems quite a different situation than that the Australian Navy's provided another substitute Indonesian fishing boat to take them back.
Yeah, that's right. This boat is now sitting off Kupang. It's been impounded at the moment. I don't know where it originated from, whether it was an asylum seeker boat that the Australians had or they bought a fishing boat. Who knows? But this boat, perhaps it was deemed more reliable than the one that they were already on, safer to push them back to towards Indonesia.
What's been the Indonesian response to this other fishing boat arriving in their waters? Had they been warned by Australian authorities?
No, the foreign minister has made a point today of saying that he wasn't told that there was a pushback going on, and they were taken by surprise. No one was out looking for it. It was a fisherman who found it and helped them come back to Kupang. And the Indonesians are a little bit miffed about it.
How are they expressing that?
Well, they've said that they're opposed to turnbacks. Today, the Deputy Foreign Minister has said that there was no information given by Australia, and he's seeking clarifications from Australia about what exactly happened.
Well, the final results were announced last week in Myanmar's historic national election, but the winner has been clear for some time. Aung San Suu Kyi and her National League for Democracy party trounced the military-backed ruling party and are now in discussions about the transfer of power. Our South Asia correspondent Liam Cochran has this reflection on the election.
The crowd was heaving, an exuberant sea of opposition supporters in red shirts and bandanas, dancing and singing in front of party headquarters in Yangon. But we had a problem. We'd lost our ladder. Somehow, in the shoulder-to-shoulder crowd, cameraman David and I had become separated from our local fixer, Shane. He was carrying the aluminium stepladder that we needed to get just slightly above the crowd to do a piece to camera for TV. After several phone calls that mostly involved Shane and I shouting, "What?" and "Can you hear me?" down the line to each other, we gave up and David and I managed to get into the tray of a small truck parked in amidst the crowd. But each time we rolled the camera, blaring music would start up again, drowning out the one-minute monologue I was trying to give to describe the moment. We broke it down into chunks and spent the next hour or so trying to get enough clean takes to cobble something together. But there was no sense of frustration. The joy of that night for the thousands of opposition supporters was irrepressible and just a little contagious. The people of Myanmar had waited 25 years for this, a reasonably free national election in which they could cast a vote for the opposition and its leader, the icon of democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi. For election day itself, the ABC team met a group of Australian observers and joined them on a walking tour of about a dozen polling stations in central Yangon. The first was set up inside a Buddhist shrine, lending a helpful splash of colour and culture for our camera. Turnout was high, and the vote went overwhelmingly to the National League for Democracy, around 80%. But in Myanmar, it's not that simple. The military junta has ruled the country for 5 decades and has put in place a constitution that gives a quarter of the parliamentary seats to soldiers. It also prevents Aung San Suu Kyi from becoming president, on the flimsy basis that her sons have British citizenship. And so, while supporters partied like it was New Year's Eve outside, inside party headquarters, the mood was apparently much more sombre. Opposition spokesman Win Tain told the ABC there was a sense of relief that night that the ballot had taken place without significant violence or cheating, but there was also a dawning of the true magnitude of the task ahead. After decades in opposition, now the NLD would have to govern. There are huge challenges ahead for Myanmar, ongoing conflict with ethnic groups, the persecution of Muslim Rohingyas, and an economy that, as one analyst put it, pretty much missed out on the second half of the 20th century. Aung San Suu Kyi does her best to wear the almost impossible expectations lightly. She spent 15 years under house arrest and chooses her words carefully, but often delivers them with sharp wit and brevity. At a press conference in the days before the election, she took 80 questions from reporters, answering most with a single-line response. We managed to catch the lady, as she is known, at party headquarters, giving an unannounced speech from a balcony several stories above the street, Beatles-style. She urged supporters to be humble in victory, and after that, the rowdy public celebrations did pretty much stop. Many in Myanmar remain wary about the rapid progress the country has made in the last 4 years since the generals handed power to a semi-civilian government. They've seen things go backwards before. But the election was a huge test for Myanmar, and it does seem the country is on a more hopeful path.
In India, the gay rights movement has found some unexpected support from a senior minister in the country's Hindu nationalist government. Homosexuality is condemned by many in the country's influential religious and, of course, leaders that gay sex is still illegal in India and punishable by imprisonment. Now, the finance minister is recommending that India's Supreme Court re-examine the law. James Bennett reports.
Inside India's newspapers, a page upon page of romantic classifieds placed by parents in search of a bride for a son or a groom for a daughter. This May, though, after others had turned it down, a Mumbai daily agreed to defy convention.
My mother placed a matrimonial advertisement in the newspaper, finding a groom for me. So we have come a long way. Right from the time where she advised me to be in the closet when I spoke to her, to this day when she is out there placing India's first gay matrimonial ad.
That's Harish Iyer. The family support he enjoys is rare in conservative India, where homosexuality remains taboo for many. Family approval still plays an important part in love and marriage, and sex, which goes against, quote, the order of nature, remains punishable by life in prison.
So the story goes back to 1860, when the Indian Penal Code was enacted.
Lawyer and gay rights campaigner Denise Sheikh has fought numerous legal battles against Section 377 of India's Penal Code.
Essentially, it took off from this colonial anxiety to regulate sodomy in particular. The law was essentially used to target LGBT individuals, either directly through prosecution, but much more indirectly through persecution. So through, you know, blackmail, they were tortured, it still continues even now.
In 2009, gay rights campaigners had a breakthrough. Delhi's High Court ruled that the government was constitutionally prohibited from regulating consensual sex between adults. Following an appeal by Hindu and Christian groups, amongst others, that decision was overruled by India's Supreme Court in 2013. It's that judgment that influential finance minister Arun Jaitley says, quote, needs to be reconsidered. Mr. Jaitley has told a literature panel that when, quote, you have millions of people involved in this, you can't nudge them off. Although welcoming the sentiment, Harish Iyer says instead of telling the court what to do, Mr. Jaitley should persuade his conservative colleagues in the Hindu nationalist BJP government to abolish the law.
Soccer is what they're playing with us. I mean, we are like balls being thrown from the parliament to the court and from the court to the parliament. Now the government is saying, no, the court has to decide. So somewhere someone has to take a decision. And if Mr. Jaitley feels very strongly, he should take a decision. And he should convince his ministers and his friends in his party, which is the ruling party, to actually take a decision.
Lawyer Denise Sheikh agrees, saying although prosecutions for sex between consenting adults are rare, as long as the law remains, it will be used to intimidate.
In the meantime, people are getting arrested, people are getting blackmailed, harassed, discriminated at the workplace simply because there is this law that exists on the statute books. We need this section to just be erased of the statute books. And that's something that only the legislature can do.
India's Supreme Court has agreed to hear a challenge to its 2013 ruling upholding the ban, but it's not clear when that will happen.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. In defiance of international law, Japan will send off its whaling fleet this week to kill hundreds of minke whales in the Southern Ocean. Australia and New Zealand have condemned the move. Last year, the International Court of Justice ruled Japan's scientific whaling program was a sham that should be halted. But Japan seems more determined than ever to ensure that it not only does its whaling program, but that it survives and thrives. And for the first time, Japanese experts have revealed how the government plans to do it. Matthew Carney has the story.
In the Antarctic, Japan's whaling fleet will kill 333 minke whales this season. It's a clear rejection of the International Court of Justice ruling last year. The world governing body, the IWC, has also said Japan's new 12-year scientific whaling plan still has not been justified. The Japanese government now wants any future dispute to be settled through the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. But Japanese academic Yoshihiro Sanada says that too may prove to be illegal.
I doubt Japan would win if Australia or other countries took legal action based on this. Japan is on very hazardous ground.
Yoshihiro Sanada says his country has to face the truth, that scientific whaling is a fabrication. To date, the program has produced 666 research papers, but only two have ever been peer-reviewed.
The research is poor. They don't have to catch and kill anymore. Research can be done by non-lethal methods.
Long-time researcher Junko Sakuma says the Japanese government is now doing everything to ensure whaling continues. The industry has been given an additional $50 million and is about to set up a powerful independent body.
It's outside the government and will pay for expenses like renting ships and buying fuel, but it's still taxpayers' money.
Japanese experts say the government is damaging the country's reputation for the sake of a food and a culture that few in Japan embrace. Junko Sakuma again.
There are a few whaling parliamentarians. This is about saving face and has nothing to do with the Japanese people.
The Japanese government was not available for comment, but it seems the Antarctic will once again be the scene of more clashes and court cases. This is Matthew Carney in Tokyo.
As world powers gather in Paris to negotiate an agreement to limit global warming, most likely by 2 degrees centigrade, Pacific nations haven't given up trying to convince them they need to do much more than that. They have long argued that a 1.5-degree cap to ensure their countries to survive the stronger storms and rising sea levels global warming will bring them. But momentum is against the small island states, as we hear from Melissa Clark.
Paris is a long way from the Pacific Ocean, but the topic of negotiations here is the reality half a world away. The effect of climate change on the weather and the ocean is something Fiji's Minister for National Disaster Management, Inia Sururi-Ratu, knows all too well.
We have relocated about 40 of our communities, and we have identified another 800 or so that needs to be relocated in the near future. So it's not something that we expect down the track. It's already happening.
He's demanding the big economies and the big emitters take responsibility.
It's time. Now is the time to act, particularly for the industrialized nations, for the developed nations. This is the time to act.
The Pacific Island leaders are working together in Paris to try, not for the first time, to convince the world that limiting global warming to 2 degrees Celsius isn't enough. Kiribati Prime Minister Anote Tong.
All of those who have a great deal to lose are saying 1.5. But those that think we can get lost, they're saying 2 degrees. And now we are telling them, if it's 2 degrees, then that is trouble for us. Are you prepared to look at us in the face and make that decision?
he had that chance as he and several other small island states met with US President Barack Obama.
As I mentioned to my friends around the table, I'm an island boy. I grew up on an island and understand both the beauty but also the fragility of island ecosystems.
There are discussions going on behind closed doors about financial support for loss and damages, though Western countries won't countenance paying compensation or accepting liability. But for Anote Tong, the fundamental issue of the existence of Kiribati is more important.
I just come away from a meeting this morning with Mr. Obama, and we're still negotiating. We haven't come to any agreement yet, but I think it's the game of negotiating. But for us, it's not a game. It's a matter of survival.
With so many compromises to be made to secure a global deal, the prospect of agreement on a 1.5-degree limit is remote. Kiribati is close to resignation that what it has worked so hard for is beyond reach.
Hopefully there is some kind of a commitment to say, okay, if it's not one less than 1.5, let's go for 2. But in a couple of years' time, we'll review it and start moving down. I think that's possibly more realistic. But I think that you're going to understand from our perspective, even zero emissions is trouble for us.
Tuvalu's Prime Minister, Enele Sopoanga, is despairing at the prospect of nations deciding that a 2-degree increase in global temperatures is acceptable.
Relocation cannot be an excuse for no actions to saving people in their God-given islands. For Tuvalu, we will never be forced to move out.
And so the island nations continue their task of appealing for the world to do enough to save them.
Infectious disease experts are worried that HIV rates are rising in Australia's Aboriginal community because education campaigns are having little impact. New HIV cases among Aborigines are occurring at 1.5 times the rate of non-Indigenous people. Doctors say injecting drug use is becoming more common in Aboriginal communities, and many HIV-positive Indigenous people aren't getting tested. Bridget Brennan reports.
Until recently, Aboriginal people were contracting HIV at the same rate as other Australians. But in the last few years, there's been a concerning shift.
Whilst the HIV incidence rates are stabilising for the mainstream population, it's actually increasing in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health population. Even before reaching diagnosis, a lot of Aboriginal people in the first place have less access to healthcare, and so there's probably a lot of undiagnosed people out there.
Dr. Marlene Kong is an Aboriginal doctor and runs the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Program at the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales. She's concerned that many HIV-positive Indigenous people are missing out on crucial treatment because they're being diagnosed years too late.
When they do eventually come in for diagnosis, often it's diagnosed quite late. I think on average their diagnosis was picked up 4 years later than the average person. So picking up the diagnosis late is what we're finding in our statistics as well.
Associate Professor James Ward is an Aboriginal health researcher from the South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute in Adelaide. He describes HIV rates in Indigenous communities as a looming crisis.
So our concerns really are about, you know, the potential for HIV to really escalate in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. There are a number of risk factors that put us at particular vulnerability for HIV to escalate, and that is that we've got a very young population, very high rates of other sexually transmissible infections.
When you're talking about communities, are you talking about urban communities or rural communities, remote communities? Is it across all those sectors?
Yeah, so the spread of HIV diagnoses that have been across the country now are evenly spread between urban, regional and remote. Obviously, there's more diagnoses in urban areas because that's where the more Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people live, but it is in remote communities, and we really need to be careful about not escalating in those areas, because what we don't have in remote areas is the clinical workforce and is the levels of education.
And he's worried about the spread of HIV from injecting drug use because he's seen the drug ice become more available in remote communities.
Traditionally, there hasn't been very much reported prevalence of injecting drug use in regional or remote areas of Australia. And what we're seeing with things like the emergence of ice, particularly in remoter Aboriginal communities, is an increase in the amount of injecting that's happening in those communities. And what we're really concerned about is rates of HIV escalating in those communities because of injecting drug use.
Dr. Marlene Kong believes it's time to revamp HIV/AIDS education for Indigenous people. She says it's clear that one-size-fits-all campaigns aren't working.
There's still a lot that is unknown. Like I said, we still don't know about the knowledge, attitudes and practices of a lot of the Aboriginal community because it just hasn't been studied. It needs to be a multifaceted approach.
Aboriginal health researcher James Ward agrees. In his view, many Aboriginal communities don't have enough resources to educate their people about the risk of HIV.
I think there's been a drop-off in the quality and level of school-based sexual health and bloodborne virus education in many schools across the country. I think that needs to be revamped. And generally, more awareness about HIV and other sexually transmissible infections. I think if we could, you know, work on those initiatives as well as the, you know, distribution of condoms, making sure that people have access to clean equipment, and then I think we'd be in the right space to be able to fight this battle that looms ahead for many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. Special thank you goes to ABC Radio Australia. We'll see you again very soon. Until next time, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you all, saying so long and take care.